Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yes, there's a big debate in Australia about the gig economy, of course, and the exploitation of workers, but something that's less well known is the existence of modern slavery. I know, you heard the term correctly, modern slavery. The Global Slavery Index 2018 estimates that on any given day in 2016, there were something like 15,000 people living in conditions of modern slavery in Australia. How is that possible, you would say? Surely slavery was a thing that we associated with the 19th century. But industries like hospitality, construction, agriculture, and beauty salons continue to perpetuate the practice. Now, of course, it's illegal in Australia, but it still happens. Tonight we're going to explore why modern slavery can still exist, the conditions that provide for it, and what the Australian government's doing to prevent slavery from happening. Joining us this evening, some terrific guests. We've got Professor Jennifer Byrne from the Faculty of Law at the University of Technology in Sydney and founding director of Anti-Slavery Australia. Jennifer, good evening to you.
Thank you.
Welcome to
Nightlife. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Terrific to have you with us as well. Also joining us, Vanessa Zimmerman, who's the CEO of Pillar 2, a business and human rights advisory firm. Vanessa, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us too. And also joining us as well, David Cook, who's chair of the UN Global Compact Network Australia. He's a former managing director of a global technology firm as well. And we'll bring him in a moment on a conversation about just exactly what global supply chains can do to eradicate modern slavery. David, good evening to you.
Hi, Phil.
As well. Jennifer, we could go to you first. What exactly is it? I mean, when we use the term modern slavery, I think when we use a term like slavery, people conjure up images of, you know, slave hulks and gangs of people in chains working cotton plantations. What's modern slavery?
I think that's right. And when you think about what that meant to be on a hulk or working in a cotton plantation, it meant that a person was controlled. Mm. They had no power over their life. They were told where to eat, where to sleep, what to do. It's exactly the same now in the world. You said that over 40 million people are in modern slavery. And while people might not be chained anymore, they are coerced, forced to work against their will. They are treated just as objects, not as human beings. And we see this, it is, as you said, a global phenomenon, but we also see it in Australia.
I mean, you're distinguishing this from people being in abject working conditions.
Yeah, I am.
For example, I mean, people might think, look, you know, the job I have is extremely poorly paid and the conditions are terrible. You're not talking about that, are you?
No, I'm not talking about a bad job.
No.
I'm not talking about a job that's poorly paid or where there are substandard working conditions. What I'm thinking about is modern slavery, and that is an umbrella term that brings together a whole lot of terrible forms of criminal exploitation of people. It goes way beyond a bad job or underpayment of wages. Mm. It means that a person might be imprisoned in a restaurant, you know, where they're forced to work 7 days a week cooking food in a restaurant.
When you say forced to work, I mean, one of the hallmarks of slavery in the 19th century, as it was practiced in America in both Americas, South and North America, was that the human beings were actually owned, physically owned. They were pieces of property owned by others. Mm. Are we talking about that still?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, technically we can't own people.
Of course not.
That is a complete crime. But when you look at the definition of slavery in the criminal code that extends throughout the whole of Australia, the language of ownership is still used. So slavery is the condition of a person over any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership or exercise. So while it's not legally permissible, it does actually mean ownership. It's treating a person just as if they're a commodity, not a person with human rights, not a person with dignity. And the kind of cases that we see really highlight that. And
you're talking about people who can't who can't walk out the door and say, well, you know, stick that job, I'll get another one?
They can't do that. They might be restrained. They might
What do you mean, physically restrained?
Physically restrained or locked in a restaurant or a house. And when I'm using these examples, I'm thinking about real cases.
Mm.
It could, and I'm thinking about investigations and convictions that have taken place in Australia. So it could be a woman in domestic servitude in a house for 8 years, you know, paid maybe $200 a fortnight, not being able to go and see the doctor, a woman who did everything in that house. She had restrictions on her freedom of movement. She also subject to threat. And that is one of the common features of this kind of criminal conduct, that people are restrained, if not physically, but psychologically, through the effect of threats or coercion or deception. These are very powerful binds, just as strong as a chain.
I said 15,000 people last time they looked were in these conditions. What are they doing?
Well, that's one of the tricky things. We really don't
know. Where would we encounter a modern slave?
We don't know how many people there are, but...
For obvious reasons, I guess.
Because it's illegal, it's clandestine, people don't come forward. And importantly, those in the broader community don't know what to look for. Don't know how to recognise slavery, which is exactly what you just said. How do we find slavery? How can we identify it? Where are people enslaved? Well, it's across a whole range of industries. I've mentioned kitchens, commercial hospitality.
Mm.
It could be slavery in a farm. It could be in a kitchen. It could be in a takeaway food store.
But I'm still puzzled as to how this could occur. I mean, people can't be owned or restrained in this way in Australia. How are they restrained?
They don't have power to be able to make a decision to leave and seek help. I mean, we would know how to do that. But a person who's been tricked or coerced or threatened does not have that power. They believe that if they try and escape, they will be hurt or their family will be hurt. Or they believe that they have an enormous debt that they have to pay back. And if they don't pay back that money, there will be some damage to them.
But they must have come to Australia on a visa.
You know what? It's not only people who come into Australia. It could be Australians as well. But you're right. Many people who have been identified as being in modern slavery have been people who have come in on a visa. So think about the chef that I mentioned in the kitchen. He came in on a visa. It's an actual case. He had a visa, a gold standard visa, that entitled him to work in a commercial kitchen. And he got that visa because he had particular skills. You know, he wasn't just anybody. He knew how to cook really well.
He knew how to cook a certain cuisine.
He did. And he was undoubtedly very versatile. But he was sponsored into Australia. But then...
What, on a 457
visa? A 457 visa. Like the gold standard visa. Right. Those visas that could potentially sometimes convert into a permanent visa. So, you know, that is an example. I mean, he was deceived, undoubtedly. Then he was coerced. He was threatened. He was forced to live in the restaurant.
Why didn't he walk down the road to another restaurant and say, look, I'm a very good cook, give me a job?
He was fearful. He didn't know about Australian law. He didn't know about protections that could be available to him. And he believed what the restaurant owner told him.
Hmm.
If you leave this restaurant, I'll have you deported. You know, you'll lose your chance for a new life. You'll go to the detention centre. And you know what that's like. So this kind of threat is incredibly powerful. But, you know, there are people exploited in this way across Australia in many, many industries.
So, I mean, I mentioned nail salons as something that's been mentioned to me as a place.
Yeah.
I mean, these were places that didn't really exist a dozen years ago. But now, of course, there's one in every street corner.
Yeah.
That some have suggested that these are places that are rife with modern slaves.
Yes,
is that fair?
Look, we just nail salons are a real issue, and there's been reports of trafficking into nail salons in London and the the US. We haven't found any cases here in Australia yet, but the reports that we see coming out of the UK, you know, really are a reminder of how easy it could be to traffic and exploit a person in any industry, including in a nail salon. And, you know, for me, actually, because it's late at night and we're quite chatty, I'm going to be very personal and show you my tatty fingernails. Exhibit A.
It's not. They're not facilities that you avail yourself of.
Well, no, I just feel really uneasy about it for a whole lot of reasons. I mean, obviously, I'm a white woman. The women who work in those places are not white. It's just, you know, we're sitting in a throne. But it's more that, you know, I think about the potential for exploitation and try and, you know, curtail some parts of my life, I think.
Let's bring Vanessa Zimmerman in on this. Vanessa, you're CEO of Pillar 2, a business and human rights advisory firm. Australia has passed a Modern Slavery Act in 2019. Can you tell us what, I mean, I'm sure we're all full of goodwill about that. What does the Act say?
It's really about what Jennifer was talking about before, that a lot of an average person may not know what to look for, may not know what modern slavery is. And one of the aims of this Act was to make sure that businesses, that large Australian businesses, so it applies essentially to companies that have an annual consolidated revenue of at least $100 million Australian dollars, so big companies, that have to be able to show every year that they have looked into their supply chains, that they have looked to see if they might have modern slavery somewhere in their operations or their supply chain. So that it's really encouraging that type of inquiry.
Oh, I see. That's quite that's quite different to what Jennifer's talking about then. So it applies to big corporations, not small restaurants or nail salons.
It applies to the big companies. However, the idea is that it will trickle down the supply chain so that as big companies work with their suppliers and their sub-suppliers and others, and that also it will just start to build awareness with consumers, with investors, with other stakeholders around what modern slavery might look like. So it's not a silver bullet, but it's a really important start.
So big companies are required to look into their supply chains to ensure that no one's being exploited. Is that right?
They're required to report on that. So they're required every year to put out a report that describes the risks of modern slavery they might have in their operations and supply chains, what actions they're taking to assess and address those risks, and also what they're doing to assess the effectiveness of those actions. So it's a reporting piece of legislation, but to be able to report on that, to be able as a big company, as a household name, to actually put out a report like that, you do actually have to look. You have to understand your supply chain. You have to be able to know where the risks of modern slavery might be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking, if I'm running a big fashion retailing business, I couldn't be sure that not one single person in my supply chain is not being exploited or enslaved in terms that Jennifer's talking about. Could I? How could I be sure of that?
You can't be sure. And I think one of the most important parts of the Act is that it's not asking companies to certify that they're slavery free. It's asking them to look. It's asking them to understand that they might have risks there and to start the practices, the due diligence, to be able to know and show that they're actually avoiding and addressing any modern slavery they might have. Any company that puts out a statement that says, we are sure we are slavery free, is the type of company that investors, civil society groups, even consumers would probably assume is not quite telling the truth there, because we know that most large companies somewhere likely have modern slavery hidden in their supply chain.
Are there any actual sanctions if big corporations fail to do this?
Not at the moment. There was a big discussion about penalties when the Act came in. So at the moment, there are no penalties for not putting out one of these reports, but that will probably be reviewed in a couple of years when the Act is looked at again. In the UK, they've actually just announced that penalties will be brought in for a similar piece of legislation in the United Kingdom, which has been an interesting development in the last couple of weeks.
Okay, let's bring David Cook in on this too. I mean, David, you're chair of the UN Global Compact Network Australia, but you're also former managing director of a big global technology firm, Konica Minolta Australia, which people would know those products, I'm sure. How did you become concerned with the issue of modern slavery?
Yeah, well, the story with Konica Minolta is that we had a we had a couple of very defining moments that caused us to be compelled to tackle the problem of modern slavery. The first one was that we had a conference in Cambodia. We needed a keynote speaker for that conference. didn't really know who to get, and somebody recommended a woman who had spent the last 20 years rescuing young women from that had been trafficked into a life of sexual slavery. So for most of us listening to that talk that she gave and meeting about half a dozen of the young women she brought along who were now in their first year of university, studying psychology and law and nursing and so on, that was our first contact with slavery. And there's an expression in the human rights world which is, once you know, you can't unknow. Mm. And once you've seen, you can't unsee. You can't take it back. So I came back to Australia and I was really appalled by what I started to learn about the number of people in slavery and so on. And I turned to a few organisations. Global Compact Network was one. Andrew Forrest's organisation Walk Free in Perth was another, looking for more information. And what I realised very, very quickly is that this wasn't isolated to sexual slavery or small businesses, but there were large global corporations. In fact, arguably most companies in the world, if they weren't making goods and selling them that were made through some form of forced labour, they're at least buying things and using them in their businesses. But the next really tangible link for us was another conference a couple of years later, again in Asia. We're on a ship one night and there was a dinner and an awards night, all that kind of stuff. and there was a talk given about or it was an optional talk that people could go to. And actually, I was there with my daughter. She went along, I didn't. Mm-hmm. It was about Thai cuisine and Thai culture and so on. And somebody asked, well, we're out in the middle of the ocean. It's pitch black, nowhere near the coast, but we could see dotted lights all around in the ocean. And somebody asked, what are those lights? And the cruise director said, well, they're Thai fishing vessels. And at night they shine these lights into the water and it attracts the fish and so on. And then the woman said, it's interesting you should ask that, because just recently we actually went out during the day in a little dinghy and asked the captain of one of the boats, could we come on board and talk to them about what do they catch and so on. He said, sure. So she stepped on board the boat, and the first thing she saw was a man sitting on the deck of the boat with a collar around his neck, and attached to the collar was a chain, and he was chained to the deck of the boat. And she said with great alarm, who's that? And the captain looked down and he said, oh, it's a slave. So notice the dehumanizing language, not he's a slave, but it's a slave. Mm. It was a commodity to him. He'd bought this person from a trafficker. And she said, but you can't have slaves. And with a sweep of his arm indicating all the other fishing vessels right through to the horizon, he said, most of us have slaves. And she said, but why do you have him chained up? And the captain's response was, he's a troublemaker, but not for much longer. It'll be fish food soon. So they're going to murder him. They're going to throw him overboard. And he said, but if you're so concerned about it, you can buy it off me if you want to. And they negotiated a price, which was 700 US, which was probably seven times what he paid for that human being in the first place. But this cruise director of this boat bought this human being, took him back to the boat. They deviated from their normal course. They went to a police station and they set this person free. We don't know what's happened to that person, obviously, or the thousands of others in that predicament. But that man was from Myanmar. He'd signed an employment agreement. He thought he was going to Thailand for a good job, but he was tricked. And he'd, you know, been out at sea for an indeterminable amount of time. That's when I realised that seafood was finding its way into the global supply chains of arguably some of the world's biggest food companies. Maybe finding its way into the restaurants in Australia that we eat at, finding its way into cat food and so on, supplied by global food organisations. And that's when I realised I'm running a company in Australia, an electronics company, and I don't actually know where all the stuff comes from. I just didn't know. And it didn't feel right. And that's when we started.
Hmm. What did you find when you did start?
Well, I think what we found initially is that our level was one of immense ignorance in our own organisation. But we gathered our suppliers together. Initially, it was about the first 40 suppliers. And these were the people that we bought stuff from. So this is sometimes a bit of a misunderstanding where people might say, well, we're in Australia, maybe we're the arm of a global company, but we don't make anything. You know, we're a bank, we're a stockbroker, we're, exactly. Whatever. We don't sell physical products, we sell services.
Because this is what modern industry is about, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So that doesn't affect us, so that's somebody else's problem. But what we all need to realise as business leaders is that we all consume things in our companies. So at Konica Minolta, we bought uniforms for our service engineers. We buy office furniture and do fit-outs. We have commercial cleaning contracts. We didn't know how those commercial cleaners were paid, were they paid fairly or weren't they? We didn't know where the cotton in the cotton T-shirts came from. We didn't know where they were made. We were completely ignorant. And what it dawned on me was that I've always regarded myself as a moral and ethical person, and I suddenly realised I couldn't actually do that anymore until I went down this path and put resources and time and people into finding out, as a company, were we inadvertently complicit in modern slavery or not?
I'm talking about the concept of modern slavery, or the practice of modern slavery, with David Cook, who you just heard speaking, a chair of the UN Global Compact Network Australia, a former managing director of a global tech firm too, Konica Minolta Australia. Professor Jennifer Burns with us too, from the Faculty of Law at the University of Technology in Sydney, and founder director of Anti-Slavery Australia. And Vanessa Zimmerman too, CEO of Pillar 2, a business and human rights advisory firm. There's kind of two issues here, Jennifer, here, aren't there? I mean, this Modern Slavery Act and the supply chain issue is one thing, but that's a big corporate thing. And then on the other side, there is the grassroots, the on-the-ground slavery you're talking about, which is small businesses importing 457 people on 457 visas and then giving them to believe that 457 visa means that they have to do exactly as they're told or else.
So I think that's right. In both cases, the concern is for the person affected, the person in slavery, and that's what the Modern Slavery Act is about too, thinking about the risk of modern slavery to a person. But you're right, it does appear that there's a bit of a disconnect between the kind of cases that we know exist in Australia and the impact of the Modern Slavery Act, where there is a whole apparatus that's been created to respond to that act. I agree with Vanessa that the act is a good step forward. It's important. It is mobilising attention, harnessing energy.
But it doesn't really do anything for the sorts of examples that you're talking about.
No, it doesn't. And it's, the act itself, I would like to see strengthened. And, you've already mentioned the issue of penalties, but there are other measures as well that would strengthen the act. And one of those would be the establishment of an anti-slavery commissioner for the Commonwealth, a person that would have oversight of Commonwealth initiatives to respond to modern slavery. It's important that we focus on the victim, on the survivor, so the cases that I was speaking about, but also to look at supply chains. And they are both important pieces of the puzzle. But
have there been successful prosecutions in Australia for this?
Yes. So there's been around 23 convictions in Australia since 2004. The majority of the convictions have been for sexual servitude exploitation offences.
This is women who are brought here to work as sex workers.
Women who are exploited in servitude, so there's no choice there. But also there's been cases of exploitation in the home. So the domestic worker case that I outlined earlier is a case that did result in a conviction. This was a woman who was in prison in a home for 8 years. That was Australia's first forced labour offence. There's been other convictions for servitude, and one really interesting.
Can I just ask you? I'm intrigued as always by the detail of these things, because you can't import a person on a 457 visa to work in your house. You won't get a visa for such a person. So how do these how do such people?
Well, it's it can be coming into Australia anyway. I mean, for that particular person, there was a tourist visa. Obviously, you're not allowed to work if you've got a tourist visa. So there was an immediate issue with immigration. But
you mean these are people who might not, in fact, they might be staying illegally in the country, well, and they're
definitely
a
not
person
entitled.
Over them says, well, look, you know, I'll have you deported if you don't do as I say.
So people who are not entitled to work, or people whose, you know, her visa would have run out. You know, she may have come to Australia on a visitor visa, but that would have run out and she would have been unlawful. But, you know, it could be anybody on any kind of visa. And, you know, another area of major concern is women on temporary partner visas. And, you know, you don't think about slavery in that context, but there are reports that suggest that there are women on temporary partner visas, you know, on track to get a permanent spouse partner visa, but who are exploited terribly in the home to such a high degree that they are victims of a modern slavery offence. You know, one of the other cases, you know, that I think it's interesting to think about is this concept of exit trafficking, Phil. So this is a new concept for us, although it was part of Australian law from 2005. But since Australia recognised forced marriage as a kind of modern slavery, we've seen something develop that we never thought would happen, and that is that Australia has become a source country for modern slavery, in that Australians are being taken out of Australia for the purpose of exploitation in forced marriage.
Hang on, explain that.
It sounds odd, but we have...
Sounds extremely odd. Well, no, just give us an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I can. So I've just got to say, so we have an offence in Australian law called trafficking.
Yes.
And it's called a facilitation offence, and it mostly applies to people who are brought into Australia, like the 457 visa holder or the tourist, the woman who became a domestic servant. But, you know, we also know that trafficking, the facilitation of a person, may also take place when a person is taken out of Australia. So what we have is young Australians, typically young women, generally permanent residents or citizens, who are taken out of Australia for forced marriage. And this is, in fact, the category of report to the AFP that exceeds all other categories. So this form of modern slavery, which is forced marriage. It's been really difficult.
How on earth do you do anything about that?
You know,
because after all, these events occurring in countries beyond the reach of Australian law.
Well, they're often starting in Australia. So, you know, what do we need to do? And, you know, this is a really good thing to be talking about. So, you know, one of the things we need to do is to raise awareness about these issues. So you've mentioned that I'm at Anti-Slavery Australia. So we have a dedicated website, mybluesky.org.au, that is focused on forced marriage. It's possible for people to contact us securely through that website. We have another website, antislavery.org.au, which is a pathway to an amazing new free course about all forms of modern slavery.
Vanessa, how just back on the supply chain issue, because you might think that's one way to attack it that might be quite effective if there were sufficient penalties. How credible is it really, or how possible is it to hold companies to a very high standard of accountability in relation to their supply chain?
Expectations are growing all the time, and we see in particular from investors. And when you think about what types of stakeholders or pressure a company may listen to the most, there might be investors, there might be, again, civil society groups, customers, obviously government actors. And these types of groups are all really increasing their expectations of Australian companies about what they're doing in their supply chains. A couple of years ago, it would have been simply, do you have, let's say, a human rights policy, or do you have a code of conduct that your suppliers have to sign to show that they understand your expectations? Now these types of groups, including investors, are asking much more sophisticated questions about what types of inquiries the company is making in its supply chain, how often they are speaking to their suppliers about this, how they've trained their people. And so it's getting to be much more of a strong expectation. And it comes back to what David was saying before as well, which is an expectation that companies actually understand who they're buying from, also in some cases to who they're selling to. And one of the interesting points that perhaps brings some connections to what you were saying before with Jennifer is that there might be, for example, a property company or a leasing company that needs to start looking at who they're leasing their properties to. For example, in malls, in, you know, shopping malls, those types of things, where there might be nail salons or other types of businesses going on where we know there might be a risk of modern slavery. So it is becoming more accepted. It's still very difficult. Companies that have in excess of, let's say, 50,000 suppliers, they're obviously not going to be able to look into each of those suppliers in the same way. So they have to prioritise and look where there might be the most severe risk of.
I wonder, David, how likely or possible any of this is. These days, particularly in modern complex manufacturing of a type that Konica Minolta would have done, there are components that are sourced from all sorts of places. And, you don't know the employment conditions of all those suppliers, and they can tell you anything they want, can't they?
Yes, I think that's very true. I don't know if this is actually the case, but somebody said to me once that there are 700 different parts in an iPhone that come from hundreds of different companies.
They would come from hundreds of different companies, exactly.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. So this is the concept of tier one, tier two, tier three suppliers. And most organisations at this point in their modern slavery journey, if you like, are focusing on tier one, which I think is fair enough. They will graduate to those tier two, tier three suppliers in time. But the point that I like to make to business leaders is that this, you don't have to just view this through a moral or ethical lens or even a legal lens or a compliance lens, as in there's now an Australian Modern Slavery Act. Oh, we have to put a report in, do we? Oh, well, okay, what do we have to do to comply with that report?
See, I don't want to be harsh about this, but I mean, a lot of what you're describing to me sounds like just a salve for big companies to say, oh, well, you know, now we're concerned about it, because there don't appear to be any sanctions that they will suffer, nor are they expected to look that far.
Yeah, and the government's initial position with the first 3 years of the Australian Modern Slavery Act is let's try and create a race to the top where organisations seek to be the best in their field at tackling modern slavery in their supply chain, rather than whipping those at the bottom who are laggards. I think in 3 years' time, personally, probably penalties will have to come in. And I think corporate Australia will have been given 3 years to wrap its head around this, and that would be quite reasonable. But the point I like to make also is that it's very, very good for your business if you seek to tackle the issue of human rights abuse in your corporate supply chain. And it's on all sorts of levels. It's a very responsible thing to do. There is a very strong return on investment if you are a responsible business. And this really came home to me when I was the CEO of Konica Minolta. I invited everybody who'd been in the company for 25 years or more to fly to Sydney, and I took them out to dinner just to say thank you. There are about a dozen people. They're all service engineers, the people that come into your office and fix your equipment when it breaks down or whatever. We had a very nice meal, and at the very end of the meal, one man at the end of the table who hadn't spoken all evening, he's a very quiet man, he said, could I please say something? I said, of course. He stood up in the middle of this public restaurant and he made what I reckon was the first speech of his life. And what he said was, I've worked here for over 25 years. That's why you invited me to this dinner. And for 25 years, I've never told anybody where I worked. Now I tell every single person I meet that I work for Konica Minolta. And why do I do that? I do that because I feel so proud to work for an organisation that would care about young women in Cambodia who've been trafficked into a life of sexual slavery.
But are there examples in Konica Minolta where you've said to a supplier, we're not buying your stuff anymore, even though you're the cheapest, because we don't like the people, the way you treat the people that work for you? And you've gone to a supplier who's actually more expensive?
Well, our preference in working with the suppliers was to sit down and say to them, we are starting to learn about this. We want to help you to learn about it.
Mm.
Because if you do want a long-term supplier relationship
with us... But there
haven't
been examples where you've done that.
Well, there's probably one example where we were purchasing marketing materials, including cotton polo T-shirts with a logo embroidered on them. And we were about to buy 300 for a conference and every delegate got one, that sort of thing. And they were purchased for us by a marketing company. And we went to them, a marketing person came to me and said, look, David, I've done what you told me to do. We're going in, we're asking these questions now. Where are these things made? Who's, you know, what are the conditions and so on? We've gone to the T-shirt supplier and I've got good news and bad news for you, David. The good news is that the current supplier could tell us nothing and was not that interested in doing the hard yards to find out. But we've found an organisation that can pretty much guarantee where it's come from, where the cotton was grown, how the people were treated, so they're ethically sourced. The bad news, David, is that it's going to cost more per T-shirt. So I said to that person, so just so I'm clear, your question to me is you would like me to tell you whether we should keep buying the T-shirts probably made by slaves or we should switch to the T-shirts that probably aren't made by slaves. Is that your question? It's a no-brainer, Phil.
Mm. Yeah, Jennifer, you were not Jennifer. Sorry, back to you, Vanessa. I'll come to you, Jennifer, in a moment. Is this the way forward? Do you think, Vanessa, that that companies are going to have to say this? Because I'm just thinking, in modern capitalism, this is a most unlikely event that's going to occur, isn't it? That companies will say, "I'm going to make my supply chain permanently more expensive," based on the fact that I'm no longer going to source the cheapest components, I'm going to source the most ethically produced components.
It may not
How likely is that going to be?
I think it's becoming more and more likely because it's not, as David said, sometimes it's for moral reasons, but more increasingly now it's because of the market. It's because customers or, again, investors or others are expecting that the company will do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen examples of tenders for very big projects where there might be three companies bidding for a project and the company that has been able to show a real commitment to managing their modern slavery risks or broader human rights risks is the one that might be chosen because it might actually be seen as the company that's least risky in the long term for the customer. So I think it is becoming more likely. And in places like Europe, we're seeing even stronger legislation coming in, not just about modern slavery, but other forms of human rights harm linked to companies too. We'll just see this continue.
That is true, that the modern corporations these days are under a lot of pressure, aren't they? From shareholders too. To adopt a more ethical face on the business that they do. Just back on, Jennifer, to you. What can an ordinary consumer do? I mean, if you have a favourite nail salon, I mean, do you cross question the people who own that salon? What do you do?
You know, I think this is the huge challenge to learn more about modern slavery, and this is really the first step. So, I am going to just say that we did launch a brand new free course on modern slavery. It's available online through UTS, Modern Slavery. It runs through the context of modern slavery in Australia and around the world and the indicators of different forms of slavery. So learning about modern slavery is the first step. But yes, what can we do as citizens and consumers? One of the things that I was really proud to do years ago when the Modern Slavery Act was being contemplated is to advocate for a broadening of the Act that would extend the requirements to government as well as business. So the Act covers not only large corporations, but any large entity like universities or hospitals, but it also requires the Commonwealth government to produce a modern slavery statement each year.
Mm.
And that is something that is really significant. And what they've done just is to prioritise.
Are employers required to give their employees a statement of their rights? Why do you laugh?
Oh, I'm just wondering. I think that...
I mean, because it might seem to many that might be an immediate and practical step.
Absolutely. I mean, people need to know what their rights are at work.
And to be given that message in their own language.
And it's the kind of things that unions used to do.
Exactly.
It's really important. You've got to know what your rights are at work. But I just wanted to just briefly circle back to this example of the T-shirt. So the Commonwealth has said that they're going to prioritise some areas, and one of those areas is clothing, you know, the sourcing of primary products, but also the making of clothing. And if you think about the Commonwealth, well, they produce a lot of uniforms, don't they? You know, they've got a defence force and others. So, you know, this is a very powerful, it's a powerful potential to change behaviour. And it's not just corporates, it's government and it's large institutions like my own institution at UTS.
Mm. All right, just a couple of calls. John, g'day.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi. Look, I got a couple of questions about airlines and merchant shipping.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really oil-rich companies in the Middle East, which are dictatorships, and they have very successful airlines. Australia's major airline is in a partnership with one of these. These oil-rich dictatorships in the Middle East, they employ huge numbers of expatriate Asian workers
mm-hmm.
in conditions which a lot of people think are slave-like. So if Australia's major airline is in a partnership with one of these Middle Eastern airlines, and you have a supply chain of services being provided to that partner airline, and those services to maintain that partner airline are effectively in slave-like conditions, doesn't that create a certain culpability for Australia's major airline? That's my first question. The other question is about merchant seamen. In this pandemic, we have merchant ships coming into Australia, delivering goods, all kinds of goods, and taking goods from Australia, and the merchant seamen are not allowed to get off their ships. Some of them have been stuck on their ships without getting off them for like 18 months.
Yeah.
So they are effectively slaves. We're benefiting from this. Why isn't the Australian government talking to countries like the Philippines, where a lot of these merchant seamen come from, or the ports where they pick up the goods, to work out some arrangement so that these merchant seamen can get off the ships for some shore leave?
Mm. They're both good questions, aren't they, Jennifer?
Yeah, they are. I'm really concerned about the merchant seamen too.
And I mean, this is an issue that's been raised a lot over the years, hasn't it?
Yeah, exploitation of seafarers is an ongoing issue.
Yeah.
It isn't one that's being tackled so far within the context of the Modern Slavery Act, but it is a major issue that's being dealt with through ILO.
Hmm. David, just back to you on that, on the other question though, this issue of partnerships with companies, and all companies do this. All companies have partnerships with other companies for all sorts of reasons. In this instance, Qantas questioning their partner in the Middle East about who they employ and why is not likely to be met with much of a cooperative response, I imagine, would it?
Look, it's hard to know. I'm not in the boardroom for Qantas, but I think they're very good specific examples that have been brought up. But I think you could bring up examples in almost every industry and every sector. And the word culpable was used. I think there are very few organisations that aren't possibly inadvertently culpable for the continuation of modern slavery in their supply chains. If you're not in discussion with all of your suppliers, all of your partners, all of your stakeholders around these issues, then you have actually made a decision to do nothing or to do little or not to do enough. So I wouldn't point the finger just at Qantas. There's a huge amount of more work that needs to be done. And I think it needs to be done at the top. One of the things I don't like is an organisation just saying, oh, we've got a sustainability manager, potentially a few rungs down from the executive team, and they take care of all that stuff. I don't think that's good enough. I think if you regard yourself as a business leader, the word leader means you need to show leadership, and the most senior people in our corporations in Australia need to step forward and take responsibility for these things.
Yeah, well, hear to that. Jan from Gippsland says, I saw a fashion designer on the drum who said all $5 T-shirts are made by slaves. I mean, there's no way they can't be. Anything else? She said you need to pay $25 to $30 for a T-shirt to be made ethically. That would be right, wouldn't it, Vanessa?
And it can be right. And I think there are certain buying practices or certain types of purchasing practices which we know can give rise to exploitation. And part of the point of this Modern Slavery Act is really to say to Australian companies, you need to think about how you are buying certain goods. Can you make something for that price without there being some form of modern slavery or other form of exploitation? And if you can't, what are you going to do about it? So it is an important point.
Mm. Yep. All right, Phil, g'day. Hi, Phil.
Hi there, how are you?
Not bad.
Yeah, look, I had a surf company, or, you know, pretty big company, and I was getting T-shirts from the company and was concerned about that sort of things you're talking about. So I travelled over to China myself and was sort of buying off clothes with high quality that as cheap as I could get for the quality and, you know, a bit of embroidery, a bit of, and also a bit of artwork too, a bit of print, you know, of my logo. And once I ventured over there, because I wanted to go and see the factories and work out what was going on in the worry of slavery, I got to the factory, was picked up in China went from Hong Kong to China to the mainland, and that was a daunting enough effort going into China, you know, realising that when you go through the, you know, up the walk to into China, you know, there's quite a stacked deck there that sort of says, you know, you are now under our rule.
Of course.
Yeah, you have no right to be an Australian or American or whatever. You could be shot, you could be taken out, you could be whatever. Anyway, so that was a little bit daunting. But we get into mainland China. We go with one of the company directors all the way to the factory. And the factory was reasonably large, I suppose, but there was 1,200 people in there. And to me, they're all had no chairs. They're all actually on the concrete, you know, with their legs crossed and sort of doing the product. And admittedly, the thing is, for a lot of people, is it doesn't matter what product you make, you've got to then be able to sell it to the shop. And the shop then has a percentage rate. And some particular shops, mostly, were sitting on around 100% in my particular industry, being the surf industry, and which is the public doesn't want to hear that. So you've got to be able to get a shirt that you then can sell to the shop, say, for $12, say, if you're going to sell it for $25.
Yeah.
Whereas if you sell a cheap shirt, then people think it's a cheap shirt. So then if you're going to put it up to some of the bigger brand names, then it needs to be sold for $39 or $40. So you can I could have afforded to put some embroidery in, some extra things in, but to me, it wasn't good enough.
Yeah. No, I get that. I get that. Vanessa gets back to this issue, I suppose, as to how much of a change we're seeing in corporates that, you know, who are saying, well, the circumstances under which we source goods are as important as the price at which we source goods, because I've never talked to a corporate executive in my life who didn't want to be the cheapest supplier.
Yes.
For their goods, because that's the mark of success, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. But I think what we're seeing, and my bar may be fairly low, but at least now they're looking and they need to look, and they know they need to look. And so if we can start to get some change through that, it is going to take time. And it means that the companies also need to prioritise where they're looking. So it might be certain countries where we know there are higher risks rather than places that might be lower risk. But I think we will see some change.
We're also going to have to get used to the fact that we ought to be, in some instances, paying more for things. Do you think, Vanessa?
That's right. There might be a cost to that. And I think consumers need to understand that if they do care about these issues, there may very well be a higher cost involved.
If they're buying a T-shirt for $5, it wasn't made by someone who's getting paid fairly.
That's right. And there are some really good tools out there where you can you can go onto the government's own register that has big fashion companies' modern slavery statements on there. But there are also some other tools out there, the fashion guides, where you can go and see whether your favourite brand is looking at these types of issues according to various questions that might have been asked.
And just back on this domestic issue, just to get back to you, Jennifer, I'm not trying to sound old-fashioned about it, but there was a time when there were workplace inspectors who would go to such places. I mean, whether they be shops or restaurants or nail salons. So I don't want to single out nail salons, but they have come up a bit in the conversation tonight. Mm-hmm. There was a time when you know that sort of inspection facility was commonplace. It's not anymore. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, it's not in either the state or the
at a union level, or even at a government regulator.
No, yeah. That's right. We don't generally see inspections unless there's been a serious complaint made that's been assessed as serious. So it is something that's gone by the wayside.
Hmm.
But, you know, this is where, you know, raising awareness for consumers to get a sense of what might be appropriate is really important.
Hmm. Yeah, I wonder, what do you think, Vanessa? Are we as consumers alive to the idea of interrogating a product and thinking, I wonder who got paid so little that they can make this thing for that price?
We could be more alive to it. I think there are a lot more questions we could be asking as consumers, as employees, like the caller that called in before, as investors. If you're a shareholder in a major Australian company, you could be asking more questions. Mm. So I think we do have a long way to go there.
And David, that's probably right when you talked about leadership before, that this idea that it's got to come from the top most likely, and that you know, pressure from investors and shareholders is okay, but there needs to be pressure too from boards, don't there?
Yeah, and I think it starts with awareness, and that's at a consumer level too. And just in terms of informing the consumer, if I can mention a free app that anybody can download,
yep.
It's an Australian-developed app. It's called Good On You, and it gives a rating on most of the apparel manufacturers.
Okay.
So I wouldn't walk into a department store and buy a T-shirt without pulling out my iPhone, looking at the app. And if they get a low rating on human rights or environmental sustainability,
it's called Good On You, is it?
Good On You. Then I won't buy that product. I'll walk away and spend my money somewhere else.
Piece of practical information.
Yeah.
Good on you. Thank you. thanks, David. David Cook's chair of the UN Global Compact Network. Professor Jennifer Burns is from the University of Technology, Sydney. And Vanessa Zimmerman from the Pillar 2. Thanks to all of you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.